So you've made it through the first day. Respect. Congratulations. Mazel tov. The first day of retreat is never pleasant, and it's rarely easy. It's just the way it is. We've come in from our lives, which, you know, for some of us they're very busy, some of us may have more relaxed lives, but none of us have a life that looks like this, what we're doing here. So for all of us, it involves a certain amount of adjustment. You know, this first day, probably the first couple or few days, they're very much about settling in and just kind of cajoling and, you know, kind of gently encouraging the mind and the body to get on board with what we've undertaken for this period of time. Adjusting to the periods of sitting, you know, which for many of us, if we're still for a long time in the course of our ordinary lives, that means it must be time to go to sleep. It's the only time that we're actually still. Adjusting to the weird kind of walking, you know, being with, you know, almost 100 other people without making eye contact. There's just a lot to settle into and to get used to. So this first day, especially first few days, are just very much about that. You know, so this may be the most difficult day that you have here on the retreat. Can't promise that it will all be uphill from here. But just to know that if it's been a struggle to get through today, that's very much par for the course, even for those of us that have done this many, many times. You know, the first day coming in and just adjusting to what's going on here is a challenge. And especially with this heat that we're having, very stupor-inducing. So it's helpful in these first couple of days, and really in all of the days we're here, and really in all of the days of our life, to keep the bar pretty low and not be too hard on ourselves and be realistic about, you know, just what it takes to do this practice. It's not easy to convince the mind to keep coming back, keep connecting with the present moment, what's actually going on. And it takes a lot of trust in the Dharma. This is one of the reasons why we go to refuge to the Dhamma or the Dharma. Just trusting in the process, you know. Thousands of people have done this practice here over the course of the last almost 50 years. And we're still here doing this because it works. You know, Sharon says, it's unlikely that I'm going to be the one that it doesn't work for, you know. So we really can just surrender to these very simple instructions, a simple practice, and just let it do its work on us without feeling like we need to force it or make it happen or do something that we just really can't do. I often remind myself that my best is enough. You know, whatever our best is, if we just do our best with sincerity of intention, with integrity, then it will be enough. There's this really famous quote from Thoreau, one of our local Dharma poets in this area of the world. He wrote, "I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not when I came to die, discover that I had not lived." Really famous quote. I remember hearing this one for the first time when I was in high school, I think. But it's very much what we're doing here. You know, Thoreau retreated to Walden Pond, and very much the same that we're doing, way that we're doing here, out to the country, living deliberately, with intention, fronting the essential facts of life. That's really what we're up against here. What's really going on? What's the essential truth of what's going on from moment to moment? And seeing if we can learn what that has to teach us. The style of practice that we're offering here on this retreat, on this Mahasi-style retreat, in the West it tends to be called insight meditation, as in the Insight Meditation Society, or sometimes you hear the term Western Vipassana. Vipassana, as it's practiced here in the West. In the original Pali language of the Theravada, the early Buddhist schools, which is the same language that our refuges and precepts are in, it's kind of the Buddhist equivalent of Latin. It's the canonical language. It's a dead language. It's only used for preserving the teachings at this point. So in the Pali language, this practice is actually called Satipatthana Vipassana. Satipatthana vipassana, the technical term for what we're doing here, which we could translate as insight based on mindfulness, or insight grounded in mindfulness. So sati, some of you might be familiar with that term, means is what's translated as mindfulness. There's a lot that could be unpacked there, actually. It's a translation that was made in kind of the Victorian era by the first Western scholars to encounter this style of practice. And we could debate whether mindfulness is really the best term for that, but that's what we're used to, sati. And then there's this term vipassana, which is usually translated as insight into English. And again, we could debate whether that's really the best translation for that, but that's what we tend to use. And then there's the patana, which is usually translated as foundation or ground. So you put all those together and you get something like insight based on mindfulness, or insight grounded in mindfulness, insight built upon mindfulness, something like that. And mindfulness, as we all know, is having a bit of a moment here in the West, has been for quite a number of years now. It's becoming a longer and longer moment, where it's really being adopted with enthusiasm into many different areas of our Western culture. But many of us, when we first come in here to the Insight Meditation Society, may not be aware that mindfulness meditation, in the way that many of us often initially encounter it, is, I think of it as a spin-off. It's a spin-off of Satipatthana Vipassana. So just like, you know, a popular sitcom, that, you know, there's some kind of supporting character that becomes very popular, and they're so popular that people just want to see them in their own show, so they get their spin-off show where they get to be the main character. So mindfulness meditation is kind of like that. It's a spin-off from Satipatthana Vipassana, and in a broader sense, a spin-off from Theravada or early Buddhism. So mindfulness meditation has become popular in its own right, often within a secular context, often within a psychological context or a social context, outside of its original setting, outside of its original context. So it's just good to have that framework for approaching what we're doing here, especially with this particular style of practice. So mindfulness is the tool, it's the practice, it's the methodology that we're actually using here, which, as we probably all heard, it's remembering what's actually happening in this moment. This word sati comes from a root that has to do with memory and remembering. So I think of it kind of as remembering what's happening right now. So we can remember what happened before, you know, we can conjure up a memory, or we can kind of come to in the moment and remember what's actually happening right now, which we often forget. So sati is this kind of remembering what is actually happening right now, moment by moment. So training the attention to stay with that flow of changing experiences, which are really pretty limited. I mean, our experience as human beings are really pretty limited. There's really only six of them. And the Buddha taught about the six sense bases, you know. So we have the body, kind of the tactile body. We feel things through the nervous system as physical sensations. We have seeing, if the eyes work. We have hearing, if the ears work. Smelling, if the nose works. And tasting, if the tongue works. That's pretty much all that goes on in terms of physical activity. And then we have the whole realm of mental activity, which is considered another sense organ, like what we might think of as the nervous system, or the brain. The cognizing, conceptualizing function of the mind is considered just another sense organ. It's another way that we contact the world and experience the world through. So we're really six-dimensional beings. This is really all that's ever going on in any given moment. And everything else that we add into that, you know, everything else that we think is going on is all interpretation. You know, very complicated, you know, very sophisticated, layer upon layer upon layer of interpretation, but it's all constructed out of ideas that we build in the mind. At base, on what we call the absolute level, all that's ever going on, like in this moment right now, what's going on? We feel things in the body, maybe we're seeing things, maybe we're hearing things, maybe smelling or tasting things, and we're thinking things or having emotions and stuff like that in the mind. that's all that's happening right now. And that's really all that's ever happening, despite all our illusions to the contrary. So learning to tune into this absolute level of experience and just be with the sensations of the breath or be with the sensations of walking or whatever kind of mindfulness techniques we may have learned, it turns out that just in and of itself, that technique, that style of meditation, that style of contemplation, reflection, just in and of itself has many benefits. And some of us probably know these for ourselves. Many of these benefits are the reason why we initially come to practice. So like mindfulness-based stress reduction has become really popular. There's many great apps out there, online services, books, all sorts of resources where we can learn to do mindfulness meditation to help with stress reduction. This is why I initially came to meditation, was through this route, and many of us do these days. In Burma, they say it, the way they describe this is that they say that mindfulness purifies the blood. So there's this understanding that, like, on a physiological level, you know, it releases built-up toxins, it releases tension, releases anxiety, releases depression. Mindfulness also has the benefit of being kind of a performance booster, right? Like a lot of sports teams or corporations, you know, have gotten into mindfulness just because it helps people to focus better, you know, work together better as a team, get into that zone, really be in the flow of whatever task it is that they're trying to excel at. It can lead to what we call psychological insight, which we tend to get a lot of here on retreat, seeing our conditioned patterns, the conditioned patterns of our neuroses, our unhealthy patterns of, you know, thought, feeling, relating to those thoughts and feelings, and to be able to hold those more skillfully, to be able to roll with those more skillfully, to be able to make different decisions about how we do or don't act those out. Mindfulness can be tremendously helpful in relationships. So both of my kids have gotten mindfulness training at school, maybe perhaps some of yours as well, just because the schools find it so helpful in dealing with bullying, dealing with conflicts that may come up between the kids, you know, keeping the kids on task, keeping them working together as a class, all these types of benefits. And for us as adults too, mindfulness can be tremendously helpful in our relationships of all sorts, just being able to be more present and be more connected with another person or with a group of people. So all of these benefits of mindfulness meditation are great. You know, these are all things that each of us could use more personally and on a community and a societal and a species level. We can just use a lot more of this in the world. So to the extent that this practice of mindfulness and all of its various incarnations that it's taking these days is spread out and disseminated more and more throughout our society, you know, it can only be beneficial. But mindfulness meditation is not actually intended in its original context to be an end in and of itself. It's meant to be a tool for insight based on mindfulness or insight grounded in mindfulness. So even though a very simple secular practice of mindfulness can have many benefits, in the bigger picture, it really is intended as a vehicle to give rise to insight, to give rise to vipassana, which is to say a little bit more about that word vipassana, because this is something that our Burmese teachers would always explain. So passing on a little bit of the transmission, this is like Mahasi Method 101, your first talk, you would always get this explanation of what is vipassana. So the word pasana in Pali means seeing, in a literal sense. It just means like seeing, pasana. But then it gets this prefix of V, and that's a little bit more mysterious and different. Pali scholars explain it in different ways, but the way that our teachers explained it is it means varied, kind of like this from the same root as varied or various, the V. Vipassana has the sense of seeing in different ways or seeing differently, seeing things differently from how we usually see them or seeing different things than we usually see. So this word that we translate as insight has this sense of seeing things differently from how we usually see them. Seeing things from a different perspective, from a deeper perspective, seeing things more clearly, seeing more acutely what's actually going on moment by moment in reality, as opposed to in our thoughts about reality, but in actual reality, seeing more clearly what's really going on there in this experience that we call life, you know, my life, being alive, being a human being. So the teaching that we offer here, Satipatthana Vipassana, this is insight based on mindfulness, where mindfulness is the method, it's the tool that we use in the service of arriving at the result of insight, being able to see things differently than we usually do. Mahasi Sayadaw had a contemporary, another great teacher of the 20th century, one of the great Burmese masters of the 20th century, who was called Thongpulu Sayadaw, the venerable teacher who came from the town of Thongpulu. And both he and Mahasi Sayadaw were widely considered to be arahants. You know, people don't tend to come out and announce, oh yes, I am a fully enlightened being, but you know, in the traditional Burmese culture, you get a reputation that people will kind of say, you know, yeah, I bet that guy, he really seems like a fully enlightened being, you know. So both Mahasi Sayadaw and Thongpulu Sayadaw and a couple of others had this reputation that they were probably fully enlightened. And this is a little teaching from Thongpulu Sayadaw that I like a lot. It's called What Makes a Meditation. When you know that you're feeling greed, you're no longer in ignorance, but possess knowledge. If you know that you're angry and feel hatred, you're no longer in ignorance, but possess knowledge. When you know that you're confused, that knowing becomes knowledge, and it is a meditation. Even if you become aware of the feeling, I don't want to meditate, that means that you have the understanding that you don't want to meditate. Since you know that you don't want to meditate, that knowing becomes the meditation, the mindfulness and awareness that you know what you don't want to do. I find this very reassuring. There's really no way to do it wrong, as long as we're just doing our best to pay attention to what's actually going on. And this is really what mindfulness comes down to. It's so simple. It can be difficult to grasp, but it's just simply knowing what's going on in this present moment. Knowing if we're sleepy, knowing if we're restless, knowing if we're filled with desire, filled with aversion, knowing if we're totally confused, knowing if we're totally bored. You know, whatever it is, just simply knowing what's happening. It's so simple, but it turns out it's really hard to be that simple. So it's another adjustment that we have to make in settling in here, because we're used to being really complicated. So we have to, little by little, you know, let all the complications, all the distractions go, and come down to just this very simple place. In this moment, what's happening? It's really very binary, which I find really funny. You know, either we're lost in thought, we're in some thought-constructed fantasy, memory, planning, whatever it is, we're off in some thought-constructed world, in which case we cannot do anything. We're lost there. You know, we have no power in that state. Or we're here, you know, that's, we all know there's that magic moment when suddenly we're back, you know. Maybe we're back and we're really sleepy, we can barely keep our eyes open. Maybe we're back and we're really confused. Maybe we're back and we're really in pain. Maybe we're back and we really want something else to be going on. It doesn't matter. In that moment that we're back, in all the moments that we're back, in all the moments that we're here and not lost in our thought-constructed world, there's the ability to know, to some extent, something that's happening. It's really simple. So mindfulness is incredibly powerful and at the same time really simple. For a long time, it can be hard to buy into this. For a long time, it can be really hard to accept this. Most of us, when we encounter this, you know, we can hear the I Ching and say, okay, that makes sense. But to really just sit and be with our experience and take in that all we need to do is just notice, that can be hard, because we hear all these great things about mindfulness. It has all these benefits. You know, it has kind of immediate benefits in our worldly life, secular life. It has potentially, you know, this benefit of insight and great spiritual benefits that we hear about. how can it be as simple as just sitting here and noticing another moment of falling asleep, noticing another moment of being lost in thought, you know, noticing another moment of being in pain? How can that get me, you know, from point A to point B? So again, this is another place where it's important to connect with our faith, our sense of confidence, take refuge in the Dharma. You know, okay, these people, they've been at this for a while. They're up there saying these things. They had teachers who were apparently pretty impressive dudes, you know, who said the same thing. Can I just take refuge? Can I find my place of confidence? Can I find some faith that if I just do this, that I too can benefit from it? So as we go on in our practice, we gradually come to realize this, that it really is just that simple. And we usually arrive at that understanding little by little through the process of elimination. So we may come in to retreat, doing this in a more intensive way, or just when we pick up mindfulness practice with various ideas that we might have about what's involved, based on what we've heard, based on what we've read, or whatever sources of information we might have had. And then as we go along and we actually try it out for ourselves, we start to see, oh, that idea that I had about mindfulness, about practice, that's not actually really quite how it is. You know, oh, that one over there, that's not quite right. So little by little, we kind of shed all of our complicated ideas about what we need to be doing and are able more and more to just rest in this place of simple presence. So I want to spend a little bit of time that's left, and just talk about some of the misconceptions that we commonly have about mindfulness meditation that come up. Or actually, to be totally honest, these are misconceptions that I had about mindfulness practice, and then I needed to figure out, so perhaps you can benefit from some of my mistakes and save a little time. So one big point that we wanted to make about mindfulness, all of us on this team, is that mindfulness is not just about being in the moment. It's not just about being in the moment. Although it's easy to get that impression from the way the instructions are often presented. So, you know, we may hear a lot, you know, just rest in the moment, just be with things as they are. You know, don't get lost in the past, don't get lost in the future, just be here now. And this one's a little tricky, because all of that is an aspect of mindfulness. You know, that letting go of the past, letting go of the future, settling into the present, that is an aspect of mindfulness meditation. But it's only a partial picture if we're practicing insight based on mindfulness, if we're heading in the direction of insight. So, for example, if we think about young children or animals, and how we are when we first come into this world, we're totally in the moment, right? Those of us that have had children or spent time around young children, they're totally in the moment. So a baby or a young toddler hasn't developed, you know, literally, like in terms of just their brain development, hasn't developed the ability to conceive of past and future. All they have is the present moment. And yet, it's also very clear that there's not a whole lot of wisdom there. There's not a whole lot of mindfulness there. There's not a whole lot of awareness. There's not any real understanding of what's going on in the present moment. And it's actually a very difficult and vulnerable way to be. You know, we see this with young children. So it's not that we're trying to get back to some kind of childlike state, some kind of infantile state that we once had, like we've fallen from grace and we need to get back to that original state of purity. Of being a young child. It's not like that. With young kids, when something pleasant is happening, you know, when they're pleased and enjoying themselves, it's wonderful because they are totally there in the moment with it, right? That's the gift of having time with young children. But then when something unpleasant happens, you know, they're also totally there in the moment with it. You know, they're defenseless. They haven't developed the tools. They haven't developed the wisdom. They haven't cultivated the resources to be able to cope with that. And all they really know how to do is either to lash out at what they don't like, try to push it away, or try to get away, try to run away, or to try to get something else to soothe them, or at least to distract them from it. I had a little bit of an illustration of this recently, earlier in the year, when I was traveling with my son, who is my youngest, who's getting a little older now, but still not, he's still a little guy, although he's getting bigger. But we had gone on this cross-country plane trip, as we do more than I would like to visit our extended family on the other side of the country. And we had, you know, plane travel right now, as I'm sure many of you know, is kind of a nightmare. But we'd ended up, the four of us, in the very last row of the plane, where the turbulence is the worst and the seats don't recline. It's right near the bathroom, and it was a really rough flight. And on the descent, he got this horrible inner ear pain, you know, like young children and even adults sometimes do. And he was in incredible amount of pain. And we were trying to tell him, you know, take a sip of water and give him the water and stuff, and swallow or yawn. You know, we were like trying to give him anything to help relieve the pain. And he's screaming at the top of his lungs. And he's not a little baby, but he's a bigger guy, so the whole plane can hear him screaming at the top of his lungs. Just an abject, you know, distress. Till the flight attendant, showing my age, the flight attendant, who I'm sure is prepared for this kind of thing, you know, sidled up and said, "Here, have this box of little chocolate candies. You can chew on these." That totally solved the problem, you know. Then he said afterwards, you know, it's a lot easier to put up with things when you have chocolate. So unless something happens to change our course, this is pretty much the strategy that we continue to pursue in finding happiness in life, right? We get better at it, maybe. We get more sophisticated, maybe. This is how most of us go through our lives, you know, running away from pain, doing our best to run away from pain, chasing after pleasure, or finding distraction from pain, never really getting a chance to just rest, because there's always some experience that has to be gotten away from or gotten to. And we call this the wheel of samsara. And we'll never find real peace. We'll never find real contentment, real satisfaction on the wheel of samsara, right? It is an endless chase. It's, you know, it's classically in the West here, we often use the metaphor of the hamster wheel. It goes round and round and round, and the hamster never gets anywhere. It's an endless chase. There's never a place of satisfaction running from pain and seeking pleasure. It's a game we can't win. So just being in the present moment, you know, being in kind of this naive state of just floating along, bobbing along on whatever's happening, in and of itself is not enough. A number of us here practice with another Burmese teacher who's around now, called Sayadaw U Tejaniya. And he has one of the books that he wrote. It's called Awareness Alone Is Not Enough, which kind of is making this point in much greater detail. Awareness alone in and of itself is not enough. So we need to actually know what's happening in the present moment. And this is how the Buddha gave the instructions for mindfulness meditation, which I think we've already mentioned, but over and over again in the old teachings, the early teachings, you find instructions like breathing in, one knows one is breathing in. Breathing out, one knows one is breathing out. Breathing in short, one knows one is breathing in short. Breathing out long, one knows one is breathing out long, you know, like this. So, you know, very much giving this formula that it's really got two components. You know, the first one is to actually be in the experience of the moment, what's happening. But then there's this other component of actually knowing what's happening. You know, awareness with discernment, and awareness with wisdom, awareness with knowledge. So as we're sitting and we're feeling the breath, for example, something that I spent a lot of time doing in this style, it's not just to be kind of bobbling along on the breath. You know, it's possible to do that, to just kind of, sort of be there. You know, we're not lost in thought. We can tell the breath is happening, but we're not really taking in, you know, okay, is this a deep breath? Is it a short breath? Is it shallow? Is it, you know, long? You know, how does it feel? Is it stretching? Is it relaxing? Is it, you know, how does it feel? How is it actually? So there's also that ingredient that we need in order for the mindfulness to actually lead towards insight, in order for satipatthana vipassana to actually happen. So this is one of the reasons why Mahasi Sayadaw emphasized the noting technique, which we talked about a little bit, which maybe some of you are very familiar with. Maybe for others it's new. This technique of putting just a little soft mental note on experience as it comes up. I think of it as like a post-it note. You know, post-it note has just that little bit of sticky stuff, and when you put it on something, it doesn't make any noise, and it doesn't make an impression or anything. It just kind of sticks, right? So that's how I think of the quality of noting that's most helpful. It's just really soft, just really light. Like, okay, in-breath, there's the in-breath. Out-breath, there's the out-breath. Just kind of direct, continuing to direct the attention to what's going on. And it doesn't have to be those notes. You know, the idea is that the notes land on whatever it is that we're actually noticing. So if we're feeling the rising and the falling of the belly, and what we feel maybe is stretching, then we know, stretching. There it is. You know, if we're feeling contraction, then we, contraction, put a note on that. So in this way, we keep directing the mind, developing this quality of discernment, or what's called strong perception, developing the capacity of mind to not just rest in the present moment experience, but actually take it in. As Steve likes to say, to grok it, you know, to really get, okay, here's this moment's experience, and this is what it is. So Mahasi's instructions very much mirror the way that the Buddha's instructions are in the Pali Canon. So this is just a little excerpt from Mahasi's instructions for how to practice Vipassana. He says, when one wants to lie down, it is noted as wanting to lie down. Wanting to lie down. While one prepares the bed, they note all of the movements of the arms and legs as lifting, stretching, repositioning, and so on. As one is actually lying down, one focuses on the whole body that is gradually lying down and notes lying down, lying down. When feeling the touch of the pillow and bedding, one notes that as touching, touching. When finally lying, the movements of the arms, legs, and body are noted, as well as noting the adjusting of one's posture as one is laying in the bed. This should all be done slowly and mindfully. Then, if there is nothing else to note, one should focus on the rising and falling of the breath, noting it continuously. So just this gentle moment by moment, what's happening? Okay, the arm lifting, lifting, lowering, lowering. Smiling, smiling, you know, looking, looking. This just gentle stream of keeping the sense of connection with what is actually happening in the moment. And many of us, it seems to be, do not love this noting tool, especially at first. It can feel very cumbersome. It can feel like a lot of doing. It can feel kind of like it's inserting a layer of interference between, you know, the mind and the experience. It can feel kind of clunky. But actually, for most of us, this tool, at least at some times, is really helful. So if you're feeling an aversion to it, if you haven't really tried it out before, or if you have tried it out before and you're still feeling resistant to using it, and especially in these early days of the treat, we really encourage you to at least give it a good college try, because it can be really helpful. If we just like, you know, kind of like, okay, I don't love this, but let me just do it. They say it's helpful. Just try to bring it in a little bit here and there. It can be really, really helpful for sharpening up the faculty of mindfulness. So that note that we make, that little post-it that we stick on experience, obviously it's not the same as the experience, but it's said to be like a classical metaphor, as it's like a finger pointing at the moon, right? So like, you know, the finger is not the moon, but it points the vision to where the moon actually is so we can see it. So it's like that with the noting. The note of pressure is not the same as the experience of pressure. But if we stick that little note on it, then the mindfulness might actually be able to get to the sensation of pressure and contact it more precisely, more directly. So some good advice that I got during the time that I was a nun at Panditarama, part of the way that this style of meditation, Mahasi meditation, is practiced with monastics or people who teach it in a very traditional way is you actually go and speak to the teacher every day, or almost every day, usually like 6 days a week, just for a few minutes, just a few minutes check-in, and you describe to them, what did you note as you were breathing? How did you note the in-breath and the out-breath? What did it actually feel like? How did you note the steps as you were doing the walking meditation? What did the movement, the lifting, the placing feel like? How did you note it and notice it? That's pretty much what the initial stage of practice consists in. You sit, you follow the breath, you walk, you follow the steps, you go in, you see your teacher, you tell them about it. And then they usually don't say much. They say, okay, keep going. Try harder is a common one. please keep going. Please try harder. Until they're satisfied with the degree of discernment, your ability to rest in the present moment and actually discern and take in what's happening there. This is the way that it goes. And I was really struggling with this during this longer period that I was there as a nun at the beginning, because this was the first time I'd been asked to do this kind of check-in with the teacher in this very formal way. And I just couldn't figure it out. And, you know, I was kind of young. I didn't know what I was doing. And I'd go and see this very imposing meditation master. And he'd say, please try harder. And I'd be like, what? I don't know what to do. I don't know what they want from me. So fortunately, there was a senior nun who was staying there at the same time, a Western nun who spoke English. And I went to her one day just, you know, despondent because it was another day of, you know, please try harder. And I didn't know how to try harder. And she gave me this one piece of advice that for some reason, I was just ready to hear it, I think. She said, try to pay attention to the breath as if you were going to have to describe it to somebody later. Which upon reflection seems like obvious, right? Because that's what I was being asked to do. But I hadn't been doing that. I'd been sitting and kind of, you know, pretty calm at that point, and just kind of floating along on the breath, but not really taking it in, not paying attention to it, kind of with the level of discernment that would be necessary to actually describe it to my teacher. So I was like, oh, okay. You know, so it's a little bit different way of attending than we might be used to. It requires a subtle mental shift. You know, can I pay attention to this in such a way? Like if I'm sitting here feeling the breath, if somebody came up to me right now and tapped me on the shoulder, could I tell them what the last breath felt like? And it's a little bit different way of attending. It's a little bit sharper, more precise, more kind of a penetrating way of paying attention than we may be used to. And this is what we're going to ask you guys to do as well. So tomorrow we'll be starting the practice discussion groups, and you all will have an opportunity to see if you can describe a breath, if you can describe a step. You know, some of us may ask you to do that, some of us may not. We'll see. But it's a really good exercise. Again, like with the noting, it can feel very awkward. Like we're not used to coming in to talk to somebody and telling them, well, when I breathe in, I feel, you know, blah-de blah de blah. I feel stretching and, you know, pressure and heat. It's not the kind of conversation we're used to having with people, and it can feel very stilted and strange. But it's a really excellent training, you know, having somebody hold us to account for paying attention in this way. You know, it's one of the ways that we really support each other. You know, we're gonna hold you accountable for actually doing this practice, for actually being there in the present moment and taking in what you're feeling. Because we're going to ask you to tell us. And we'll give you more guidance about this as we go along so that you get the hang of it. It's a learning process, learning how to do this. Some of you have done this style of meditation before. You're a little bit familiar with it. For those of you that are new, we know it's going to be just strange at the beginning, and it's going to be a little alien. So we'll help you through that. You don't need to be intimidated by it as much as we were by our monastic teachers. So mindfulness. Mindfulness is not just kind of floating along in the present moment. You know, awareness alone is not enough. It's not getting back to some kind of childlike state, but it's really being aware with a lot of discernment and a lot of presence. It's also not trying as hard as we possibly can to connect with the present moment. This is like an important point to get, one that can take us a while, again, through trial and error to really get. You know, in our culture, here in the West, I think we're particularly prone to working too hard in the practice, setting the bar too high, because we have this really strong work ethic, this puritanical-based work ethic, the idea that if we really want something, we need to give it 110%, give it everything that we've got, right? Which in some areas of life is certainly true. You know, it's not that we shouldn't work hard for things that we want, but we can get conditioned to be inclined that way with everything, including with our meditation practice. And this is one area where that extra 10% really is not helpful and is generally actually counterproductive. It can lead to what we call striving, really trying to make the practice happen, because we don't trust. We don't trust in the Dharma. We feel like we need to make it happen. So it can lead to working too hard and over-efforting and feeling like if we're not constantly working really hard to be mindful every moment, then we must be slackers. We must not be doing it right. So we can fall into thinking that that's an inherent quality of the meditation, an inherent quality of the mindfulness, is it has this very ardent, kind of forceful quality, that this kind of strenuous effort is really required, you know, to force the mind to stay on the breath, to force the mind to stay on the steps, to force the mind to stay present, or, you know, to zap every single thought, you know, zap them all, you know, like space invaders, each thought that arises. But this kind of really strenuous effort is actually too much. So that's not mindfulness. The quality of forcing, of strong effort is not an inherent quality of mindfulness. And we invariably find that it's not effective, it's really just exhausting. So if we're feeling as the days go on, like meditation is just so much work, you know, like I remember in the early many years of my practice, you know, coming into the hall here and sitting, you know, sitting right here in this hall, and at the end of the meditation session, at the end of the sit, the bell would ring, and I would be just like, oh, I gotta go take a break because I am so tired. You know, that was so much work sitting there for, used to be an hour, now it's usually only 45 minutes. So if we have that feeling at the end of a sitting period or end of a walking period, like, oh, that was just so much work, you know, that's really a red flag that we are trying too hard. We're working too hard. We're making too much effort. It should be much more easeful than that. It doesn't have to be that kind of strenuous effort, moment after moment after moment. So we really want to be the tortoise, not the hare, like in that famous fable. You know, just kind of keep putting one foot in front of the other. You know, it's a marathon, not a sprint. Upandita used to warn us how to not be gecko yogis. Like if you've been in tropical parts of the world, they have these lizards that live on the wall, and they just kind of sit there. So like if we were in this hall in Burma, there'd be like a lizard sitting over there and maybe one over there. They're territorial, so you don't get too many of them in the same place. But they have their place where they camp out, and they sit there, and they just eat all the bugs that come within their domain. So they're actually considered very auspicious, good companions to have. So they'll just sit there and sit there and sit there, and then all of a sudden there'll be a bug, you know, a few feet away or whatever, and then they'll dart off and grab the bug, eat that one. And then they'll sit there and they'll sit there and they'll sit there, and then another bug, they'll dart off, get that bug, and then sit there and sit there. So Sayadaw used this as a metaphor for how not to practice. You know, we don't want to be like, you know, making a whole bunch of effort, you know, sprinting really hard, doing as much as we can, you know, and then be exhausted and just kind of collapse and like let it all go and fall apart for, you know, until we feel like we're ready to make the next big of effort and pull it all back together again. It's much, much more effective to just apply a much gentler level of effort, but more steadily, you know, so that we don't have these big ups and downs. And this is what is actually most helpful to settling into the retreat container. Just a gentle but steady, as continuous as we can be kind of effort. You know, not pushing too hard, not totally slacking off, but finding the middle path. You know, not too much effort, not too little effort, but just the right effort, the mama bear effort. And what we find if we pay attention is that the amount of effort needed to be mindful of any given moment is actually very little. Right? It's actually almost nothing to just be aware of something in this moment. So without changing posture or anything right now, if you just bring your attention to wherever your feet are, one of your feet, pick a foot, what do you feel in that foot? We know, right? It's not very complicated. You know, as I feel my foot, this foot here, right here, I can just feel pressure. You know, it's just touching. It's obvious if I just put my attention there. It's not like I have to go looking for it or figure it out. It's just there. You know, there's the feeling of pressure, the foot on the cushion. So it takes almost no effort in one moment to notice what's happening. You know, if we rest the attention on the breath, if that's what we're doing, don't need to go searching around, rooting around, you know, trying to decide what the sensations are. We just put the attention there, and then we just notice, oh, it's moving, you know, or it's stretching, or it's relaxing, or whatever it's doing. So we really don't have to make the knowing happen. The knowing happens automatically, just as long as the attention is there. So we can think of it as making an extremely light effort. Recently, I've been telling people, see what the least amount of effort you can make is and still notice something that's happening in the present moment, and that's probably the right amount of effort to be making. Because we just tend to push too hard. The trick is to make, you know, just the lightest amount of effort. You know, just what's happening right now, what's obvious, what's just presenting itself right now. And then right now. And then right now. And then right now. And to just keep doing that, moment after moment after moment. And when we practice in that way, then it becomes very easeful. It becomes very relaxing, rather than feeling like a huge chore and a lot of work. Just what's happening right now. And then again, and again, and again, as we go through the day. In as many moments as we can. In the moments when we're not lost in la-la land. The moments when we're lost in la-la land are beyond our control. The moments when we're back, we can just open and connect and take in what's happening in this one moment. There's another study that I read some years ago that I find really reassuring. This was a study done in Toronto, where a group of researchers, you know, they've been doing all this research into the effects of mindfulness meditation, again, for quite a number of years now. The body of research on what mindfulness meditation and insight actually does in the brain is growing. But this is one study where they took two groups of meditators. So they took one group of meditators that had done an 8-week MBSR course, just learning kind of basic mindfulness 101 meditation techniques, and they'd been doing it just for a short amount of time, 8 weeks. And then they took another group of people who had no meditation experience, they'd never tried it. And they had the people from the two different groups get into the functional MRI, always a fun experience. And they scanned their brains as they meditated. So the people that had already had an 8-week MBSR course, they just did the techniques they had learned. The people that were totally new, they gave them some basic meditation instructions that day, told them to try it. And the results of this were interesting. So both groups of people, the ones that had a little bit of meditation experience and the ones that had no meditation experience, they both, across the board, everybody said that their minds were just all over the place. That they were just constantly thinking, they were lost in thought, you know, they had very few moments when they were actually present. It was really hard to concentrate. So the subjective experience of the meditation seemed to be about the same in the total beginners versus kind of like the not quite beginners. But when they looked at the brain scans, they found a very different picture. The images of what was going on in the brains of people that had even just 8 weeks of experience looked very different from the people that had no experience. So I like this study because it just shows that we cannot evaluate how our practice is going. There are many, many times when we feel like it's just nothing's happening. We're just lost in thought. We're just caught and struggling with physical pain. You know, we can't find the breath. We can't stay with the breath. It feels like it's all just not working or going to pieces. But it is not necessarily so. And we tend to be really bad judges of how our practice is going. So that's also part of our job, is to reassure you. Even if it feels like nothing's happening and it's going to pieces, don't believe it. There's a lot that's happened, even just here today. Even just one day of doing this practice all day long with sincerity of attention has an effect, has a big effect. And that will build over the days that you're here, even if it's not always particularly pleasant or not always how we would like it to be. I'll just end with this famous quote from the Buddha. This was kind of his final word on this practice of Satipatthana Vipassana. He said, "This is the only way for the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, for the destruction of suffering and grief, for reaching the right path, and for the attainment of peace, namely, mindfulness." So let's just be quiet for a moment.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.